Bill Longley watched as folks from the town meeting spilled out onto the street, attracted by a wagon drawn by an exhausted pair of mules. A sleepless, restless man, he shouldered off a post and stepped to the edge of the hotel porch. Tam Sullivan stepped through the door and stood beside him.
So you're a window walker like me, huh?
Man of my profession lives longer that way. I make it my business to know what's going on.
Hell of a night.
Is the only weather in this country wind and sleet?
I don't know. My first time here. It'll turn to snow soon. Getting a man down from the box.
I got a bad feeling about this. I reckon I'll go take a look, see?
Sullivan made a little bow and extended his arm.
After you, Bill.
I'd hardly shoot you in the back front of all these people.
I don't think there's any way of telling what you'd do, Bill.
Longley adjusted the hang of his guns.
Damn. Just got my boots cleaned.
We all have a cross to bear. Lead the way. I'll be right behind you.
Yeah, well, don't get any ideas, bounty hunter.
Me, Bill? Well, I wouldn't dream of putting a bullet into the back of your skull.
The body lay face down on the boardwalk, and no one seemed willing to pull the arrow out of its back.
Here, I recognize that, Randy.
Clem Weaver lifted the dead man's shoulder with the toe of his boot.
Yep, it's him all right. His name is Dan Cope. Runs with a feller by the name of Jack Flood. He was here in town for a spell before we run him out.
I remember him. Chicken thief, as I recall.
And a damn nuisance. He should have been hung for a pest years ago.
Apaches?
Weaver shook his head and yanked the arrow out of Culp's back.
It's Ute. And it's a war arrow, judging by the strap iron head. If the savages had been hunting, they'd have used flint.
What the hell are Utes doing this far south? They never come this far into Apache country.
A long time ago, they took a notion to mount winter raids against the Apaches. The Ute are friends with Hickoria, and they know the young bucks like to hole up with their womenfolk and youngins in the cold weather, then raid into old Mexico come spring. That's how come the Utes figured December is a good month for horse stealing.
Weaver nodded at Culp's body.
And that's how come he's dead. Must have bumped into the Utes while they was out conducting business.
I say we mount a punitive expedition. Make those damn savages pay for killing a white man.
The store owner was met with blank stares.
Tom, Ute warriors are fellers you don't want to tangle with. They're mean as hell and don't want to quit.
Seems like you're on your own again, Mr. Archer.
Sullivan, who'd been listening to the talk, wondered what was meant by that, then dismissed it from his mind.
We'll bury this man in the morning. Jim, can we put him in your ice house for the night?
James O'Rourke, the saloon owner, looked up with wide eyes.
Hell no! I didn't want him bleeding all over my ice.
Stick him in the livery. He'll keep pretty fresh in there, and I'll take care of his mules and wagon.
Bill Longley turned away, a smirk on his face. Sullivan followed him and caught the gunman just before he stepped back into the hotel.
Hey, Longley.
What the hell you want now?
Let's say you didn't take a pot at me on my way back to the train station.
Let's say I didn't.
All right, then. A person or persons unknown tried to cut my suspenders, right?
If you say so.
Suppose the Utes have gotten the Apaches all riled up, and suppose it was an Apache who took a pot at me.
So what?
Might be a good time for you to leave town.
You trying to get rid of me, Sullivan?
Yeah. You're a bad influence.
You mind that Sutton Taylor business down Texas way? Jim and Hayes Taylor and John Wesley Harden and them.
The feud is still going on, as far as I know.
Yeah, it is. Worse than ever before. Anywho, a couple years ago, back in Yorktown, Texas, the army mistook me for one of the Taylor boys. Came after me with a rope.
A travesty of justice, Bill.
Well, a month before, I'd shot an uppity black in a town called Evergreen. I figured the soldier boys was aiming to hang me for that killing.
Careless of them, Bill. Misleading a man like that.
The sergeant in command of the damn Yankee hanging squad had a better horse than mine and soon came level with me. Surrender in the name of the law. You go straight to hell, says I, drawing my revolver. This one here in my right holster. Shoved the muzzle into the sergeant's side and blew his Yankee guts out.
You're a stern man, Bill, when all is said and done.
Wait, there's a moral to the story. Maybe a couple morals. One is that I don't pull the trigger until I know I can kill my man. That's why it wasn't me who took a pot at you. If it was me, you'd be dead.
If you...
The second is that I don't scare easy. So your Apache talk is falling on deaf ears. I'm gonna take this town, Sullivan, and all that's in it. So stay out of my way. You comprende?
I've got no friends in Comanche Crossing. What do I care?
Yeah, that's true, but all the same, I saw you making calf eyes at that little York gal tonight.
Keep her out of it.
Oh, I would if I could, but I can't. See, pretty Miss Lisa's getting hitched.
To whom?
To whom? Yeah, I like that. Very good grammar as befits a fine gentleman like yourself. Lisa York is getting hitched to my dear friend and colleague, Booker Tate. A happy couple plan Christmas Eve nuptials, and I will be Booker's best man and maybe even read from the book. How's this? May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breasts satisfy you always. May you be captivated by her love. That's from Proverbs 5:18-19. My pa learned me that from the Bible when I was younger.
Sullivan was too stunned to speak. Beautiful Lisa York planned to be the bride of a savage animal like Booker Tate? It was beyond his understanding. Longley's hands made pictures in the air.
Candles, pine wreaths, frost on the window panes, the blushing bride in white silk. My mama sniffing in a handkerchief and Mayor York all puffed up proud as a pup with a new collar. I can see it all.
Yep. Booker is a son-in-law to be proud of, all right. When did Miss York say yes?
Oh, she hasn't yet, but she will.
You mean Tate hasn't asked her?
He hadn't even met her. But he saw her at a distance and right away started mooning over the little gal he calls his Miss Pretty. Well, that's when I began to make his wedding plans.
Lisa York won't marry a violent, smelly brute like Booker Tate.
Oh, yes, she will. Trust me, she will.
You mean you'll force her?
Oh, a harsh word, Sullivan. I prefer to say that we'll persuade the young lady to give her heart to Booker. After a couple years and a few beatings, she'll learn to love him. I've told you how it's gonna be, so now it's time to back off. Just stay out of my affairs.
The sleet had turned to snow, and the big bounty hunter watched pure white flakes fall onto the black mud of the street and disappear. By morning, the snow had stopped, but storm clouds piled up above the Sangre de Cristo peaks like massive black boulders, threatening another avalanche of bad weather. The air was frigid, so cold it was sharp to breathe, and the people who passed Tam Sullivan on the boardwalk were wrapped to the eyes in great woolen mufflers.
I tell you, I seen them with my own two eyes. A dozen, maybe. And painted for war, they was.
So how come you're still alive, Eddie?
The speaker's companion was an affable-looking man in a gray woolen top coat and plug hat of the same shade.
Because I hid, didn't I? And I didn't look at them direct. Look at an Apache direct, and he could feel your eyes burning him like.
And smell you if the wind is blowing right.
Ida May, looking as tired as always, came up to Sullivan's table.
Oh, this talk of Apaches is scaring me half to death.
Where did the gentleman see them?
Hey, Eddie! Where'd you see them savages?
Over to Angel Fire Peak, Ida May. Just yesterday morning. Seen them clear as day.
What the hell were you doing over there in this weather?
You know the crazy lady?
Yeah?
She asked me to guide her over there and stand by with my rifle while she gathered potsherds.
What the hell is a potsherd?
Broken pieces of clay pots and jugs and the like. And the crazy lady wanted old engine skulls.
What does she want them for?
I don't know, Ida May. She says she collects them. Anywho, that's when I seen the Apaches and wished I hadn't.
Eddie, you're as nuts as the crazy lady.
Ida May shook her head, then turned to Sullivan.
Maybe he saw Apaches, and maybe he didn't. That crazy lady is no companion for a sane man. She'll make him as tetched as she is. Still hungry?
Enough for bacon and eggs.
Coming right up.
Ida May hesitated a moment and bent toward Sullivan.
Your name was mentioned at the town meeting last night as maybe being involved in the murder of Sheriff Harm and them two others.
You believe that?
Ida May straightened up and shook her head.
No, I don't. You do look like a born killer to me, but not a cold-blooded murderer.
Well, that was a double-edged compliment.
Oh, I meant born killer in a nice way.
After Tam Sullivan ate, he asked Ida May about the crazy lady, some kind of amateur collector of antiquities, he'd guessed. Or maybe a raving lunatic.
She calls herself Lady Clotilda Wainwright, and I guess that's what she is. She's from England, but came to live here about 2 years ago. She keeps to herself and accepts no visitors.
Old? Young?
She's young, no older than 30, and quite lovely, in my opinion. Of course, I've only seen her once, and that was when she first arrived. She has a hired man who does her shopping, an Oriental gentleman.
She lives in the hotel?
No, in the yellow house at the edge of town. You can't miss it. It's got a painted dragon weather vane that the Oriental gentleman keeps bright. Several times a year, he climbs up onto the roof with a can of red paint and a brush.
Seems like an interesting lady.
She's a widow, and she's crazy, collecting broken pots and old skulls. Before you get any idea, she does not encourage gentlemen callers. Perry Cox, the banker, tried, and she left him standing at the door like a great booby. And in the summer heat, too.
I'd like to ask her if she saw the Apaches. I sure don't count to them getting in my way out of town.
Eddie Lewis was out there in a snowstorm, and maybe he saw something, or maybe he didn't. The eyes of a scared man standing guard with a rifle can play tricks on him.
Lady, what's her name, would know?
Wainwright. Yes, she'd know, but she won't tell you. You're safe here in Comanche Crossing. Why not stay here until the Apache thing blows over?
No, I don't want to do that. Just as soon as I collect the bounty on Crow Wallace, I aim to head south. If Lewis is right about what he saw, there's a chance I could lose my hair real quick.
Well, then try to talk to Lady Wainwright. But you could lose your hair real quick at her place, too.
The morning remained cold, and the clouds so low that Sullivan figured a man could reach up and grab a fistful of iron-colored mist and watch it fade away like a fairy gift in his hand. A yellow gingerbread house of considerable size, six small-paned windows showing to the front, stood on a low timbered hill to his left. The ground floor was of worked stone, but the upper level was clad in shingles. A roof of the gambrel type of moderate steepness ended in a broad gable. The house had several chimneys, an extensive porch, and multi-level eaves. Sullivan stepped through a front yard haphazardly laid out with miniature Chinese and Indian temples, Greek columns of white marble holding up nothing but sky, statues of ferocious Oriental gods, and a classical statue of a shapely nymph covering her feminine parts with a strategically placed veil. But what held Sullivan's attention was the weather vane in the shape of a red, snarling Chinese dragon, its tusked and fanged snout telling anyone who cared to know that the wind was blowing from the north. The oak door was weathered, but the brasses shone as though they were polished every day. Also in brass and just as shiny was a plaque that read, "Gun Kai." Sullivan had no idea what that meant. He fixed his smile in place and waited. And waited. Sullivan's smile that had slipped was back in place. He expected to see a fine English lady, but in her place stood a small Chinese man, slender as a girl, wearing tiny little slippers, a red silk jacket embroidered with silver dragons, and black pants.
I'm here to see Lady...
The little man, who stood as tall as the middle button of Sullivan's coat, pointed to the brass sign.
You know read?
I don't know what the hell it means.
Last word off. You work it out, big shot.
The Chinese man moved to close the door, but Sullivan grabbed him by the front of his shirt.
I still want to see the lady of the house.
Next thing Sullivan knew, he was on his back in the yard, stunned, his ribs and jaw throbbing.
Gun Kai!
Sullivan hurt all over. For the moment, he stayed where he was, staring up at the glowering sky that threatened to snow on him at any minute. He figured he'd had warmer welcomes. Still groggy, he got to his feet and made fists of his gloved hands.
You want to try that again, you little...
Are you badly hurt? I do hope not.
I guess I'm still all in one piece.
Cheng can be so rough, and he has a quick temper.
I noticed.
The woman was tall, of stately bearing, and handsome rather than beautiful, but the dark auburn hair that cascaded over her shoulders in tumbling waves was lovely beyond measure, as were her steady emerald green eyes.
You look most unwell. I suppose you'd better come inside and have a cup of tea. My name is
Lady Clotilda Wainwright.
And yours?
Tam Sullivan, from down Texas way.
Yes. How nice for you. Do, come inside.
As he stepped into the drawing room, the first thing he realized was that he was too big for the furniture. It seemed that the spindly antique chairs were made at a time when people were smaller, and women in crinolines weighed about 100 pounds. In the fashion of the period, the room was overcrowded and stuffy, with too many tables and settees, paintings on the walls, and delicate vases and ornaments on every surface. Afraid to move, he stood in the middle of a Persian rug and turned his hat brim in his hands, a tall, wide-shouldered man feeling as out of place as a preacher in a courtesan's boudoir. The room smelled of incense, like a Catholic church on a Sunday. Lady Wainwright, who had the British aristocracy's instinct to spot unease in others, smiled.
Perhaps we should repair to the kitchen, Mr. Sullivan. There's a nice warm fire in the stove.
She seated him at a more substantial pine table, then glided into the chair opposite.
Cheng will bring the tea directly, but first he'll look at your forehead. You have quite a bump and some grazing, I fear.
It's fine. Doesn't hurt anyway. Well, not much.
Oh, but I insist, Mr. Sullivan. Cheng was a fine physician and anatomist in his native China, and he's very skilled at treating bumps and bruises.
Sullivan grinned and gingerly touched his head.
And very skilled at putting them there.
Well, yes, indeed. Cheng has made a study of many ancient martial arts, and he can be quite the rowdy at times.
She turned as the little man entered the kitchen.
You may proceed, Dr. Cheng.
Sullivan tensed as the man advanced on him, but Cheng wore a wide smile and carried a bowl of water, a towel, and a small alabaster jar. The Chinese kowtowed, then straightened up.
Welcome to the home of Lady Wainwright, Honorable Sir. It is indeed a prodigious pleasure to see you here. Now, if you will permit.
As gentle as a woman, he dabbed at the graze on Sullivan's head with a damp towel.
I think you may have taken a bad fall. It is most distressing.
He spread some ointment on the wound that smelled of pine but didn't sting, then stepped back like an artist admiring his work.
There. You'll soon feel right as rain.
You may serve the tea now, Cheng.
Lady Wainwright gave Sullivan her slight smile.
Cheng is a treasure. He and my late husband were both physicians, and they met when we did missionary work in China.
I'm sorry your husband is no longer with us.
Sir Arthur was killed during the Second Opium War, trying to save China from being annexed by the Western powers. I'm afraid he failed.
And the Chinese killed him, huh?
No, Mr. Sullivan. The British killed him. On Christmas Eve 3 years ago, they stood Arthur against a wall in Nanking and shot him as a traitor.
Cream? Sugar?
No, this is just fine.
The big bounty hunter looked at Lady Wainwright over the rim of his steaming cup.
You must have been very young when your husband was killed.
Not so young. I was 28. Arthur was 40 years older than I, but he was a fine, intelligent, and energetic man, and a first-rate anatomist. As it happened, I was spared execution, but Lord Elgin, the British commander, warned me that if I ever returned to England, I most certainly faced the hangman's noose.
So that's why you came to the United States?
We'd lived in this country before, in Louisiana, where Sir Arthur was famed among his peers for his profound knowledge of human anatomy. I returned to recover from my husband's martyrdom and to do what I can to save yet another ancient culture facing destruction at the hands of the Anglo-Saxons.
The Indians, you mean? I guess they're doing all right. Which brings me to the reason I came
here. They're not doing all right, Mr. Sullivan. They will be slaughtered and humiliated just like the Chinese. Have you finished your tea?
Sullivan nodded.
Good. Then come with me. I have something to show you.
Lady Wainwright rose, and in her dark gray day dress, she glided across the floor like a ghost.
As Chinese art is defined by her bronzes and porcelain, the history of the native tribes of America is written in their pottery and in their bones. Do you understand?
Yeah, I guess so.
I am cataloging all the pottery shards I can find, and thus will preserve something of the Indian heritage before it's all destroyed. Have you ever killed an Indian, Mr. Sullivan?
Well, I recently shot a breed, a fellow by the name of Crow Wallace, but he was a murdering skunk in a lowdown.
Lady Wainwright's eyelids flickered as though Wallace's name had struck a nerve.
He was a lowdown because white men made him that way. Don't you agree?
Well, I heard tell that his white part was a mountain man, and they generally got along pretty well with the Indians.
Cheng told me there are Indian killers in this very town. I thought you were, too, Mr. Sullivan, after Cheng said you brought in a dead man who looked like an Indian.
Well, hell no. Oh, excuse me, ma'am. Heck no. Crow Wallace was half Irish, half Cheyenne, and all damn bad. Excuse me again, ma'am. He was called Crow because one time his pa took a liking to birds and named him after one.
I plan to return to China next year and continue my ministry. Until then, woe betide any man or woman I hear has been abusing our Indian brethren.
Well, I'll keep that in mind, ma'am. Now, you were going to show me something?
The door, Mr. Sullivan.
Ma'am, did you see the Apaches yesterday when you were out by Angel Fire Creek with Eddie Lewis?
Yes, I did.
10 of them?
Twice that number, Mr. Sullivan. I'm afraid they were hidden behind falling snow, and it seems that Mr. Lewis doesn't see very well.
That's a heap of Apaches. Enough to put the wind up a man.
A question for a question. Is there a man in town who goes by the name of Wild Bill Longley?
There sure is. He's not a real sociable fella.
The woman held out her hand. Sullivan didn't know if he was supposed to shake the hand or kiss it, like he'd seen highfalutin menfolk do. He settled for a handshake that Lady Wainwright readily accepted.
Au revoir, Mr. Sullivan. And remember me to dear Mr. Longley.
Tam Sullivan walked down the rise toward the street. The buildings looked like a fleet of old wooden men of war adrift in a sea of mud. The landscape, in somber shades of tan, gray, and olive green, stretched away on all sides of him, and even the branches of the pines cresting the surrounding hills were thin and sparse and brown. Winter was cracking down hard, and the north wind, flecked with snow, bit deep. In the course of practicing his profession, Sullivan had acquired the highly strung instincts of a lobo wolf. Someone, or something, was watching him. He turned and looked back toward the house in time to see a hulking figure at a second-floor window. The man, judging by his bulk, that's what Sullivan figured it was, vanished almost instantly, and the concealing curtain twitched into place again. He'd only caught a fleeting glimpse of the man, but registered what he saw with shock. A bald head and an almost featureless face, as though the skin had melted to the skull, leaving only holes for the eyes and mouth. It was the kind of sight that could come back to a man in his sleep and make him wake up in a sweat, fear spiking at him as he reached for his gun and the scarlet campfire glow. Tam Sullivan would not soon forget the face, or the fact that the man was lurking in the house the whole time he spoke with Lady Wainwright. Sullivan regained the boardwalk and saw a dozen men gathered outside the saloon, the lean, scowling, malevolent figure of Bill Longley among them. Tom Archer nodded to Sullivan as he approached.
You want to get your horse and join us?
To do what?
We're mounting a punitive expedition against the Utes. Teach them that they can't kill white men with impunity.
Ride with us, Sullivan. It'll be a lark.
Seems to me that anything that involves killing blacks and Indians is a lark to you, Bill.
Yeah, and rightly so. Oh, but don't forget Mexicans. I ain't too fond of greasers either.
You tell him, Bill.
Archer, how come you've made a deal with the devil?
We need guns. Indian fighters.
Sullivan glanced around the gathered men. Young faces, old faces, faces in between. A few of them, like Eddie Lewis, had been in the war. But Utes and Apaches didn't stand in line and fight under banners. The group in front of the saloon would be up against a very different kind of enemy.
You sweet-talked these men into joining you, Archer?
No sweet-talking was needed. These fine men are all volunteers, and they are determined to punish the savages. Well, Sullivan, will you join us?
The Apaches are out. You know that.
Yes, we do, and we'll sweep them aside. It's the Ute murderers we want.
Apaches don't sweep aside worth a damn.
And that's because they ain't met men like me and Booker Tate before.
Bill, Apache warriors are not scared unarmed Negroes and Mexicans. They shoot back.
So you say, Sullivan. They'll take one look at me and Bill and run like rabbits.
Mount up, men. Let's quit the gabbing and go get us some scalps.
You're making a big mistake, Archer.
Mister, if you ain't got the belly for it, step aside. Mount up, boys.
Sullivan caught the flash of Longley's triumphant grin, and then he knew. Longley and Tate had no intention of fighting Indians. At the first sign of trouble, they'd scamper and leave Archer and the rest to their fate. Longley intended to take over the town and empty its bank. For that, he needed to kill off the gutsiest fighting men first. All he had to do was step aside and let the Utes and Apaches do it for him, at no risk of harm to himself.
Hey, Bill, I almost forgot. Lady Clotilda Wainwright sends her regards.
She's here. In Comanche Crossing.
As ever was, Bill. Big house on the hill back yonder.
Hyah!
Longley savagely put spurs to his horse, and the big buckskin galloped along the street. Archer's baffled posse followed at a walk, and Sullivan hurriedly retraced his steps along the boardwalk. By the time he reached the end of the boards, Bill Longley had already drawn rein about 20 feet from the house.
You don't scare me, Clotilda! Don't call in favors, you hear me? We're not going back to what we used to be. I'm done with it.
The silent house stared at him with blank eyes.
Hey, come after me, damn you. Bring a dead man if you want, and I'll kill him all over again. Ha ha! I know how to destroy you. I know, Clotilda.
A moment's silence, then the only sound was the soft sigh of the wind.
What the hell was that?
Bobcat. Let's go kill some redskins.
Longley's face was white as bone. Sullivan watched the posse leave, Longley in the lead. Like any man who has spread his blankets in the woods, Sullivan had heard the screech of a bobcat. He stared at the house, saw only shadowed windows, and shook his head.
Longley, what kind of enemy have you made? What kind of woman is Lady Clotilda Wainwright?
By the time Tom Archer and his posse reached Angel Fire Peak, their enthusiasm for Indian fighting had seriously waned. The 3-hour ride across wild, broken country had tired the men and horses. The day had grown colder and the snow fell thicker. The land lay bleak and lonely under a leaden sky, streaked here and there with snow and ice that gathered in every crack and fold of the frozen ground. 5 miles to the west, the gray bulk of the Cimarron Mountains, banded by pines that marked the timberline, stood cold and aloof. Archer turned in the saddle.
Where the hell are the hostiles? Up there in a canyon or a hanging valley?
They hold up somewhere, I reckon, but real close. I thought I caught a whiff of smoke maybe a mile back.
That last was a lie, but Archer accepted it as truth.
Boys, we'll backtrack a mile. See if we can pick up the scent again.
Longley felt danger in the air, and even his horse sensed it, holding its head high, ears pricked.
Keep a sharp watch, Archer. Like I said, the Utes are mighty close, so be on your guard.
Archer's face frowned into a question.
Me and Booker will head west and take a scout around the Cimarron foothills. If we spot the savages, I'll keep watch and send Booker back for you.
I thought you said you smelled smoke south of us.
Maybe I did. I'm not sure. The wind's blowing from the north, so the smoke could have come from the Cimarrons. Look, Archer, if you and your boys see no sign of hostiles, head back for Comanche Crossing. We don't want to be caught out here come nightfall.
What about you and Tate?
We'll scout east, like I told you. If we see no Indian sign, we'll rejoin you.
And if you do see the Utes?
I'll fire 3 shots, and that means come like hell.
Archer nodded.
All right, boys, we'll head back down the trail.
Longley watched the posse leave. 10 tired men slumped in the saddles, wishing that they'd never left home.
Let them boys put some git between us and them. Then we'll do what has to be done.
Ain't we gonna scout the Cimarron foothills?
No, you idiot. Hell, I don't want to bump into Utes or Apaches. Man can get himself killed that way.
So, what are we gonna do, Bill? Tell me.
We passed the limestone ridge about a 1/2 mile back that overlooks the trail. It's got timber along the crest where a couple of men can take cover. You catching my drift, Booker?
Tate just shook his head.
We got a chance to thin him out, see? The Rubes and the posse are the best Comanche Crossing's got. I say we can cut them in half real easy. And then?
We take over the town. And I wed and bed the little York gal. And then we empty the bank and go on our way rejoicing.
You'll be a respectable married man after all that, Booker.
Well, at least for a spell, till I've had enough of her. Then we can sell her down old Mexico way for a pile of money.
Sounds like a proposition. We'll head for the ridge and make like Injuns.
When I fire the 3 warning shots, them Rubes will come hooting and hollering, and we pick them off like ducks in a shooting gallery.
Bill, damn it all, you're a genius.
Don't I know it.
The limestone ridge was shaped like the prow of a steamship, its crest covered by a mix of aspen and ponderosa pine. At its highest point, the rise stood 50 feet above the flat. To the south, it ended in a sharp drop, but on the northern side, a gradual pine-covered gradient sloped down to the trail. Longley and Tate rode up the slope, dismounted, then stashed their horses in the trees. They bellied down with their rifles at the top of the ridge overlooking the trail.
You ready?
Damn right I am. I bet you $10 I knocked down 5 of them plowboys.
It's a bet, Booker.
Longley turned on his back.
Now the fun begins.
The rate of fire of the .44 Henry was 28 shots a minute. In the hands of expert riflemen like Longley and Tate, it was a devastating weapon. Each man's rifle was fully loaded with 16 rounds in their 2 magazines and 1 in the chamber. After a couple of minutes ticked past, Tate turned his head to Longley.
Where the hell are they?
Well, they'll be here. It's a hard trail, just be patient.
The snow fell, lying thick on the backs of the prone riflemen. More time passed. 3 minutes. 4. 5.
They ain't coming. Damn it, Bill. They'd be here by now.
I don't believe it.
Archer ignored my shots. Damn traitorous swine sold us down the river. Left us here to die like dogs.
Scum. That's what they are, Bill. Just yellow-bellied scum and low down.
A bullet missed Longley's face by inches and punched a hole in his hat brim.
What the hell?
Apaches. Where? Every damn where.
His eyes wild, Longley sprang to his feet.
Hold him off, Booker. I'll go get help.
The gunman sprinted to his horse and swung into the saddle.
Wait. Wait for me, Bill.
But Longley ignored the man. He spurred his horse onto the slope. Then he spotted the Apaches. 7. 50 yards off, sitting their horses on the flat. He swung south and winced as a bullet burned across his left shoulder. Then he felt his horse stagger. The big buckskin pecked, but Longley hauled on the reins and kept the animal's head up. The buckskin kept running, but its pace slowed, and blood and foam flew back from its mouth, the bit stained scarlet. Shots racketed behind him, and then a rider drew level with him, and Longley's eyes widened in fear, but it was Tate.
Get him off me!
Bill, they ain't after us! They gave it up!
Fight!
Longley speared a glance over his shoulder. He saw no Apaches, only the lacy curtain of the falling snow, the steely sheen of ice that covered every tree and rock.
I thought Apaches were great warriors. Damn cowards, they were afraid to face us.
Tate said nothing, his face empty but for a trace of the wound Longley had inflicted on him.
I killed three of the savages.
You did?
Yeah, dropped three before I hit the flat. Damn it, man, didn't you see?
Sure, Bill, sure, I seen them savages fall with my own two eyes.
They got led into me, though.
Longley showed Tate the tear in the shoulder of his coat. There was a smear of blood on the fur.
Well, that's why I didn't hold up for you, Booker. I mean, me being wounded like that. And the hostiles put a bullet in my horse.
Will he last until we reach town?
Yeah, I'll make him last. Keep a sharp eye out for blanket Indians and Mexicans, Booker. Maybe we can go back to Comanche Crossing with scalps.
Tam Sullivan stood at his hotel room window and watched Tom Archer's posse ride in, a group of exhausted, frozen men. They'd suffered no casualties and showed no signs of wounds, so they'd obviously been defeated by weather, not Utes. He watched as the riders dismounted, then followed Archer into the saloon in search of whiskey to defrost their bones. Thinking about it later, Sullivan reckoned it might have been better for the storekeeper if he'd gone straight home to the bosom of his family.
Nothing from Santa Fe for you yet, Mr. Sullivan.
I should have heard by this time.
Maybe the lines are down. This has been a severe winter so far. Coffee?
Yeah, please.
Depends.
On what?
On how the weather shapes up or if there's Indian trouble. I hear tale of the Apaches are out.
Seems like, from what I've heard.
Maybe 2-3 days for an answer from Santa Fe. It's my best guess.
That's a lifetime in a burg like Comanche Crossing.
Oh, I don't know. We got a real nice church and there's a choir.
I don't go to church.
Neither do I. But we got a real nice one if you felt inclined.
What do you know about Lady Clotilda Wainwright? Lives in the big house at the edge of town.
She's never caught a train here.
Well, that's not telling me much. Nobody's ever caught a train here.
But if we did have trains, and I'm not saying we don't, Lady Wainwright never caught one.
So you know nothing about her, huh?
Only that she's a strange one. Keeps to herself. But I tell you what, though. Sometimes she keeps strange hours. I've seen her lamps burn all night, and she only turns them off at sunup.
Maybe she can't sleep.
That could be. But there are them who say she has visitors arriving after midnight, and sometimes in closed carriages. What do you think of them shenanigans?
You ever hear tell of a Rennie by the name of Bill Longley?
Wild Bill Longley, the Texas outlaw? Sure. Telegraph operators keep each other informed. We call it professional courtesy.
Why would Lady Wainwright know him?
I haven't a clue.
So you just heard about him, huh?
Yes, but not much. The only strange thing I ever heard about Wild Bill Longley was he got hung once, and it didn't take.
Yeah, I know about that. Seems to me it was a pity. Bill only getting half hung, I mean.
Did you hear how he got the noose off him around his neck? Now, there's a strange story. Hamp Dixon, an operator farther down the line, told me.
Sullivan shook his head, only mildly interested.
Well, they say his woman bit through the rope. Fancy that!
Later that evening, Tim Sullivan sat at a table, his back against the wall, as was the habit of men who made a living by the gun. Tom Archer strolled over, looking like he'd been through it.
Never saw an Indian. Never saw nothing but snow and ice and mountains.
You don't say. Now that really surprises me.
I'm glad we didn't get into a scrape. After hours of freezing in the saddle, the expedition was in no shape to take on Utes.
I reckon not.
Sullivan looked over the exhausted men at the bar.
Where's Bill Longley?
I don't know.
It's always good to know where Longley is.
Archer shut down for long moments before he spoke again.
Him and Booker Tate left us to scout toward the Cimarron Breaks. He said that if he ran into trouble, he'd fire 3 shots. That we should come on fast.
And did you?
No. We heard the shots, but by then my men were finished. What did Longley and Tate mean to us? I wouldn't risk the lives of my men to save a couple outlaws.
Sullivan pointed to the wall behind him.
Archer, you see writing on that? If you don't, I think maybe you should.
Longley's probably dead by now. If the cold didn't get him, the savages did.
Don't count on it. He's survived hard times and he's got more lives than a cat. Something else, Archer. Longley was raised to the reckoning, and he's an unforgiving man.
Oh.
His face troubled, the storekeeper turned and stepped back to the bar. And Sullivan waited for the tragedy he knew must inevitably come. By midnight, only Tom Archer and three of his posse remained in the saloon. Well, them, a saloon girl, and Tam Sullivan. The girl wasn't Montana Maine, and that disappointed him. Suddenly, Longley and Tate barged inside, bringing a gust of wind, snow, and knifing cold with them. Longley's coat was open and pushed back. His butt-forward revolvers made a belligerent statement. He laid his Henry on the bar, then glared at the drinking men.
You three with Archer? Got a dead horse at the hitching rail outside. Bury it.
Now?
Yeah, now.
And if we don't?
Then I'll kill you.
It's time you boys went home anyway. Just dab a loop on the horse and drag it into the trees somewhere. Coyotes will take care of it.
I told them to bury it.
Ground is too hard.
Then how are they gonna bury you? You know what? I've changed my mind. You three get my saddle off the horse and take it to the livery. Then haul the carcass up to the graveyard. You'll have some burying to do come morning.
The three men carried holstered guns, but they were up against it. No man in his right mind wanted to haul iron on a Texas draw fighter in a tight space. Not if he wanted to keep on living, he didn't. The big red-haired man considered his course of action, didn't find one he liked, and decided to call it a day.
Come on, boys, let's get the dead horse off the street.
And don't forget my saddle and bridle.
I'll go with them.
Now you stay right where you are. You aiming to take a hand in this, Sullivan?
Nah, ain't my game. I reckon I'll sit here quiet and see how things turn out.
We didn't mean to leave you in the lurch, Bill. You got it all wrong.
After you heard my shots, how did I get it all wrong?
The men were tired. They couldn't make a go of it.
So you left me and Bill to die like dogs. Was that the way of it?
No, that's not how it was. The men were in no shape to fight the Utes.
It was Apaches. Killed three or four of them, but they still got lead into me.
Jeez, Bill, I'm sorry. It was just an impossible situation. I mean, we were in the middle of a blizzard. You know how Indians fight. We could have headed right into an ambush.
Longley smiled and nodded his understanding.
You a married man, Tom?
I sure am. My wife's name is Mary, and I have two kids. John is 15, and Emily a year younger. She wants to be a school teacher.
Nice. Very nice. It's tough for a man to put his life on the line when he has a happy little family waiting for him at home.
Then you see how it is with me, Bill. I hoped you would.
Of course I know how it is with you. Yeah, go on home now. No hard feelings. It was all an unfortunate misunderstanding.
Relief showed on Archer's face. He smiled as he walked past Longley and stepped quickly to the door.
Oh, Tom!
Yeah?
Two .44 balls crashed into his chest. Sullivan stood and cleared his iron as Longley swung in his direction, just as he knew he would.
Don't try it, Bill. I can drill you right where you stand.
It was a jest, Sullivan. Just a bon mot, you understand?
Sense of humor like yours will get you killed one day.
Keeping Longley in front of him, Sullivan got down on one knee beside Archer. He'd seen a lot of dead men in his day, and the storekeeper was one of them.
Is it dead?
The bartender was a big man, thick across the shoulders and chest. His name was Buck Bowman, and he'd been a Texas Ranger for a spell, and still carried a Comanche arrowhead deep in his lower back.
Yeah, he's dead as he's ever gonna be.
Sullivan got back to his feet. Bowman, a man with no backup in him, stared at Longley.
Tom Archer has friends in this town.
Tell him to bury him. Well, they can let him lie there and rot. I don't give a damn.
Bowman's eyes moved to Sullivan.
Did you see it as fair play, mister?
His wounds are in the front.
He didn't have a chance.
No, he didn't. Not a hope in hell.
Longley hitched his guns into place.
Let this be a warning. I'll kill any man in this town who crosses me or does me wrong.
Longley walked to the door, and a grinning Booker Tate followed him like a trained puppy.
Why didn't you take a hand? You could have made a play.
Gun smoke drifted around the saloon like the ghost of Tom Archer rising from the dead.
Best advice I ever got was to never interfere with something that ain't bothering me none. It was Archer's fight, not mine.
No, I guess it wasn't. But I think I'm going to make it my fight real soon.
A sleepless man, Bill Longley knew every crack, patch of flaking plaster, and spiderweb on the ceiling, and how the silver luster of snow light cast by the window looked like frost in the darkness. He blinked rapidly, his brain working. So Clotilda Wainwright had come back to claim what was hers by right, his life. But why here and now? And how had she discovered where he was? She hadn't, of course. Clotilda being in Comanche Crossing was just a stroke of bad luck. Or was it fate, fortune, destiny? He could think of a dozen names for it, but not one was adequate.
Damn her to hell!
Longley got out of bed, slid one of his revolvers from the holster, and stepped to the window. She was there. He knew she'd be there. The woman stood on the boardwalk opposite the hotel, her black cloak and unbound hair streaming in the wind, her eyes fixed on his window.
Hag. You vile English hag.
Longley pulled on his boots, buttoned his fur coat over his long underwear, then shoved the dance revolver into the pocket. It was time to have it out with Lady Clotilda Wainwright. He owed her his life, but not his soul. She couldn't force him back into the old ways, the ways that had gotten her damned husband killed. A short time later, Longley stepped onto the porch. The night was cold, the color of slate, and snow added its cartwheeling chaos to the carefree wildness of the north wind. Across the street, the boardwalk was deserted. Everywhere he looked was shadow, deep, black, mysterious, the dark mouths of the alleys brooding like the portals of hell. He stepped along the boardwalk, eyes restless, gun in hand. Dr. Allen's Pharmacy, the New York Hat Shop, Sloan's Rod and Gun, Archer's General Store, Brian T. Grossman, attorney, Brown's Boots and Shoes. The storefronts came and went. Longley reached the end of the timber walk. On the hill, the Wainwright Mansion was ablaze with light. He stared at the house. All the curtains were drawn, and he saw nothing of what was happening inside. But he knew. It was time he had a plan. He'd kick the door in, find the hag, and kill her. Simplicity itself. Longley grimaced and shook his head. He'd let his anger get the better of him. It was too damned risky. Cheng was dangerous, and so was the grotesque man-thing she kept so well hidden. And there would be witnesses. That could be awkward. He'd find another way. Longley turned to walk back to the hotel. He peered through the murk at a patch of sagebrush some 20 yards from the end of the boardwalk and caught a glimpse of an animal. A coat the color of tarnished silver, the gleam of fangs, a huge animal. Warily, he raised his revolver. A minute slid past, the growl seeming to be coming from all around him, a savage, liquid rumble that spoke of hunger and slavering jaws. Fearful, he stepped back, holding close to the front of a footwear store. A sign in the window said, "All boots sold at cost." Longley studied the brush, searching for the animal, hoping for a clean shot. Something dripped on his hat. Longley jumped back from the store, looked up, and saw the massive head of a dog, saliva stringing from its jaws, staring down at him from the flat store roof. He brought up his revolver, but the dog was no longer there. Longley sprinted along the boardwalk.
Help me! Dear God, help me!
Terror lending wings to his feet, Longley reached the hotel door.
What scared you, Bill?
Longley whirled, gun in hand. Tim Sullivan stood halfway up the staircase. He wore his long underwear and hat and held a cocked revolver.
Ah, it's you, Sullivan.
Longley holstered his gun.
As ever was, Bill. I heard boots running on the boardwalk, and then the door crashed closed. I declare it shook the hotel to its foundations. I figured it had to be you. See a boogeyman out there?
It was a dog. Damn thing was stalking me.
A dog? You mean a little bow wow dog?
Damn you, Sullivan, it was huge. Some kind of mastiff with jaws and teeth like a bear trap.
Did it bite your butt, Bill? I sure hope it didn't.
No, it didn't bite me. Damn cur wanted to tear my throat out.
Why are you out so late? You know you shouldn't be out there in the dark by yourself.
None of your damn business. Get the hell out of my way.
Sullivan stepped aside, let the gunman pass, and watched him until he went all the way upstairs, then returned to his room. No matter the weather, be it the heat of summer or the cold of winter, Miss Angela Davenport made a weekly visit to the grave of her dear mama. Sarah Davenport had died 5 years before, stricken by a cancer that had ravaged her body and killed her before her time, poor thing. She had left her hat shop to her daughter, and with it an entry into the middle class. Angela enjoyed an income of a full $900 a year, as befitted a spinster lady of genteel status. She was a thin, some would say scrawny, woman in her early 40s, with brown eyes, brown hair, and a prim mouth. She had never lain with a man, and had long since reconciled herself to the fact that she never would. Donning her coat, hat, woolen gloves, and a stout pair of leather boots, Angela picked up her prayer book and stepped outside into the cold, windy morning. She carefully locked the front door of her house and tested the handle several times before embarking on her journey. The walk up the slope to the cemetery was always a chore, but she didn't mind, not when Mama expected her weekly visit. Angela bent her head against wind and sleet and trudged to the cemetery gate. A previous mayor had encouraged burial in above-ground tombs, but Angela did not approve. It was a foreign concept, begun in New Orleans, and it smacked of popery, a religion of which she vigorously disapproved. No, her dear mama was buried 6 feet under, as a good Christian should be. Her mother's grave lay to the right of the gate, under a pinion that marked the spot just as surely as the marble gravestone Angela had set up. She brushed snow off the top of the stone and opened her prayer book. After 10 minutes, she became exceedingly cold. After the murders were discovered, the mayor had ordered proper burials for Sheriff Harm and his helpers. Crow Wallace was also buried properly. Angela walked to the north end of the cemetery. Through the slanting sleet, she saw what looked like fresh graves just a few yards in front of her. Dear Sheriff Harm, she was sure he would appreciate her prayers. He'd always been such a nice man. A Methodist, to be sure, but she never held that against him. She stepped closer to the graves.
What in the...
Sullivan sat at a table in the restaurant with York.
Doc Harvey gave her a sedative, and my daughter's with her. She's had a terrible shock.
That's why you came to see me? To tell me the graves were empty? What business is that of mine?
No, I came to talk to you about the death of Tom Archer. But don't you think it's strange that 4 recently buried corpses are missing, including that of Crow Wallace? Now, surely that interests you.
Coyotes, maybe? It's winter. Hard times for coyotes and the like.
All those men were buried deep, and there's no trace of the bodies. The coyotes would have scattered their bones all over the place.
Well, it's strange, Mayor. I'll grant you that. If it ain't coyotes, then I don't know what to make of it.
Well, Buck Bowman, the bartender, says Tom Archer's death was murder.
Well, he saw it just like I did, and he called it.
What do you think?
Archer hadn't been notified. So, the way things turned out, he had no chance.
Then Bill Longley murdered him?
Archer was wearing a gun, Mayor.
Does that make his murder legal?
No, I guess not. But a jury would say he hadn't even chance.
Tom Archer's death, the stolen bodies, all this Indian talk... Comanche Crossing could soon fall apart.
Bill Longley is a big part of your problem, and it'll get worse. Do you know that Booker Tate plans to marry your daughter?
What? That's preposterous. She's never even met the man.
I think Booker plans on making her acquaintance real soon. He and Longley are set on a Christmas Eve wedding.
Over my dead body.
I'm sure Bill Longley can arrange that.
Oh my God, Sullivan. What can I do?
The short answer is to put the run on Longley and Booker.
We already have a widow and 3 orphans. My daughter Lisa says this town can't afford anymore.
Go up against Longley and there'll be widows, all right. The man's got a yellow streak, but when his back is to the wall, he'll fight. So will Booker Tate.
I can't take the chance of more deaths. My town is already teetering on the brink. Can I buy them off?
Yeah, with every last cent that's in the bank. And maybe that won't be enough.
A loss like that would ruin practically everybody in this town, including myself.
Better to be broke than dead.
That was a cold, heartless, uncaring thing to say, Sullivan.
It's been my experience that this is a cold, heartless, uncaring world. I don't owe this town a damn thing, so it's all up to you. Either gun Longley, or you pay him. The choice is simple.
And what about you? Will you just stand aside like you did in the saloon last night?
Mayor, I'm only passing through. Get that into your head, huh? I wasn't Tom Archer's nursemaid. He should have gone home when he had the chance.
Longley would have followed him there.
York got to his feet.
You know, Sullivan, I intended to offer you the Sheriff's Star.
Keep it. I'm not a lawman.
Well, maybe it's time to prove that you're any kind of man.